Yeah, so the reason that I gave it this title is because I was planning to give this talk, and then I went to Giorgio's talk on Thursday, and so he talked about like 45, he talked about for 45 minutes like 80% of what I was going to talk about. And so I was hoping that would mean I could get out of the talk, but then I woke up this morning and I was still on the schedule. So I thought what I would do is I would still talk about the same things anyway, because I think if you're a student, sometimes it's useful to see things from multiple perspectives. Also, my talk has more pictures in it. In any case, what I'm going to talk about is, first I'm going to review everything that Giorgio told you on Thursday. I'm going to give it a little bit more of machine translation flavor, because that's primarily what I do. Then I'm going to give you a brief tutorial on something that you haven't seen before, and probably not too many people in the room have seen before. And then I will sketch some ways in which these two topics might be related. There will be a lot of partially and totally unsolved problems that I'll bring up. And so my goal is not to solve any of these problems, is to sketch a possible solution, and also hopefully suggest to you some problems that I think are interesting. So I'll just start with some motivation for why I care about synchronous rewriting, and also automata and formal language theory and transducers and all these kinds of things, in MT, although we've made a lot of progress in the last 20 years, we still want to solve problems like this where we really haven't solved them. And so in most cases, when I have an MT system here, this is actually Google Translate. So Google Translate does this really fun thing with this this Spanish tweet here. I don't know if anyone can see what's actually going on. Why we have the English word pork appears here is the English word pork. Apparently the English word pork appears in the Spanish. Does anyone know what's happening here? Just a fun, it's porqué, yeah. So in Spanish Twitter, you see this all the time. And so our systems aren't very good at these kinds of phenomena. And we have things that are a little bit closer to the sorts of things that we care about here in the workshop, is translation of syntactic, semantic, and morphological phenomena. And this is an example from the ISI paper from 2012 that was sort of at the beginning of a lot of this work. Here's some examples that, here's another example. This is a somewhat famous sentence in computational syntax. And so there are various problems like this that I care. And so all of this is just sort of a quick example to motivate some why we actually want to view machine translation in a particular way. And so the view of MT that I have is one I didn't really come up with. It's something I got from this guy, who most of you probably know. And so machine translation is automata theory plus probability from linguistics. And there's an old saying that I think someone like Arvind Joshi or Mark Stevens says, is that linguistics tells you what to count and probability tells you how to count it. And so in the case of MT, I think automata theory is really important, because automata theory is sort of gives us lots of useful algorithms and representations for dealing with the kinds of linguistic structures that we want to actually create crowns over. And so that's all I'm gonna say about probability. So probability sort of permeates all of this stuff, but I'm mainly gonna be interested here in the automata theory and a little bit of the linguistics part. So I'm neither a mathematician nor a linguist. I learned all of my linguistics in the street. And so by trade, I'm a computer scientist. I can do a little bit of math. Hopefully, smarter people in the room will correct me about math. So let me show you how this plays out in modern MT systems. So here's roughly how Google Translate works. Google Translate is based on something called a phrase-based model of translation. And so that model works like this. So I get some input that looks like this. And the first thing I do is I segment that input into something that are colloquially called phrases in the field. But these are not phrases in any linguistic sense. They're just substrings. So we take these substrings. We permute them in some way. Then we do a one-for-one substitution of each of these substrings for some corresponding English substring. At every point, these decisions are ambiguous. So I could have permuted these in a different way. I could have substituted for them in a different way. And so here's a possible English string. And we also run this against a gigantic n-gram language model. And that's basically what Google Translate does. I'm not telling you about where the probabilities come from or anything like that. So we can think of this actually as just a gigantic finite state transduction. One way to see this is, you know, we've got some transducer that generates segmentations. We've got some transducer that takes an input and then permutes it. You have to have a finite language on one side to do this, but you can write a function that takes a finite language and then generates all permutations of all the strings in that finite language. So that's okay. We can think of that as a transducer. This is just straight up transduction. So I see these symbols and I replace them with this. And then at the end, I have some n-gram acceptor. So if I put weights on it, it becomes an n-gram language model. And so all of this is just a gigantic weighted finite state transduction. I hope this is something the speech people in the room are at least comfortable with this idea. So this should be common ground for absolutely everyone. So this is just a big function, right? So we do have, in fact, finite languages both on the input and the output. And so we can represent these things as a weighted finite state transduction. And this isn't just like a pedagogical, Bill Byrne's group at Cambridge, and Bill Byrne is also someone who's in both of our communities, has actually implemented a really, really good MT system using this idea. They basically just encode everything as transducers, they learn the weights for them, and they just run it through OpenFST, a toolkit that's a really awesome toolkit that's written primarily at Google. And so they basically have just a weighted FST translation model. So we can just think of this as sort of as composition of a bunch of functions. Maybe it's a little bit more complicated than I wrote up there, but that's basically what it is. So, and that's approximately the state of the art. This is where MT is right now. For the last 10 years, the MT community has been really, really interested in syntactic models, right? So nothing in here does anything with morphology. Obviously, it's Chinese, so maybe we don't care. We don't do anything with morphology, syntax, semantics, any of that stuff. Right? So we're not thinking about those kinds of problems at all in this kind of model. And so for the last 10 years, the MT community has been really, really interested in problems related to syntax and computational syntax. And so how might we use syntax in an MT system? Well, you might use it to inform this reordering step, for instance. That's something that seems to be really important. And so when we do this in MT, we are usually thinking in terms of what's called a synchronous context-free grammar. And so this is exactly the kind of thing that Giorgio showed you on Thursday, but I'll show you again just to remind you how it works. This formalism, by the way, is originally called syntax-directed translation. Does anyone know what they were translating between? It's Algol and machine code. So this originated in the compiler community in the late 60s, and so this is quite old. The MT people picked it up about 20 years ago and have been playing around with it ever since. So I'll just remind you, I'll show you an example in a second. So here's a context-free grammar, and all this says is, you know, I can pick up one of these symbols. I'll use capital letters for what I'll call non-terminals and lowercase letters for terminal symbols. So in a synchronous context-free grammar, we've got basically a pair of context-free grammars whose productions are linked. They're linked one-to-one, right? So if I've written them on the same line, then there's a one-to-one correspondence between these. And just as a notational convention, it will be easier to write this like this. So here I've got the Japanese, and here I've got the English side, right? And so there's another requirement in these synchronous CFGs that the non-terminals on the right-hand side of a production must be in a one-to-one correspondence. So here I've indicated that to show that this NP is in correspondence with this NP, this VP is in correspondence with this VP, and so on. And so that's basically it. This is the formalism. And so the idea is that we can then use this formalism to generate pairs of strings that we think are translations of each other. So here's a description of the generative process. Here's how we generate a pair of strings. So we always start out with some start symbol S. And so we're going to write out a pair of strings. So we've got two copies of S. But these are always linked. Right? So this rewriting is always happening in parallel. And so we just choose some rule to expand S. And as long as there are NPs, so as long as there are non-terminals, the non-terminals are always going to be linked to each other. And as long as there's non-terminals, we're always going to be rewriting. So we basically just choose to rewrite this non-terminal using some synchronous rule. And then we just continue this process all the way down until we've got nothing but terminal strings. And so this you can think of as a generative story about how this pair of strings came into existence. Right, so this is a very, very simple model. And so the nice thing about this is that we can now view the translation process as just parsing. So the way that we do that, so suppose we're given an input string that looks like this. This is, by the way, is a slide that I stole from David. I should have credited to David earlier. But this is the way that we do this is we take this input string. We first parse it to some syntactic tree. So that synchronous context tree grammar is basically just describes a homomorphism on trees. So I can take the image of this Japanese tree under that grammar to get an English tree. And then all I do is I read off the English string. And then I'm done. And so in case you're curious, so this is kind of a formal, an informal description of a formal system. There is a corresponding transducer for this. Particularly this error. Does anyone know what it's called? This is called a pushdown assembler. So this is the part of the Aho and Ullman article that no one ever reads. But it's a really interesting little transducer device. And so you can actually view this entire process as, again, just a big composition of automata and transducers. And so that's it. And so I want to remind, so now I want to give you a flavor of how we might actually maybe implement something like this, but how we can view it in a kind of, yes.
So, a question.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes. So, yes, it is. It defines exactly the class of syntax-directed translations according to Aho and Ullman. It has some funny business where there's like a register and you have to store some strings in it. It's not really clear how you would implement it efficiently, but it's there. So I want to. So we're going to go through this step by step. So imagine the way, again, as I said, translation is just parsing. So let's think about parsing for a second. And I want to give you a somewhat algebraic view of parsing. So suppose I have, this is going to be, let's say this is just the left-hand side of that synchronous context-free grammar. And I've got some, and I've got a string. So as Giorgio mentioned, parsing is really intersection. So I'm going to think of this string as really, we can almost think of it as basically just a finite language. It's basically a regular language that contains exactly one string. And so here's an algorithm that I hope everyone is familiar with. It's called CKY. So in CKY, we first, for every word in the string, we first look to see if there's some unary production that has that word on the right-hand side. And if we do, we basically make an inference that there might have been some non-terminal with this symbol. And we're going to say that this non-terminal could have produced the word here. And so we do this for all the words in the string. And now we look at all pairs of these things that are adjacent. So for instance, this pair, and we say, well, if I've got some rule that has this string of non-terminals on the left-hand side, then maybe I can infer that there was an NP that produced them, and so we get something like this. And so you just keep running this algorithm until you get a bunch of parse trees, and CKY has this nice property that encodes it into this format, which here I'm kind of using this hypergraph notation for it, but it's a chart, or it's a hypergraph, or it's an AND/OR graph, or all these things are essentially equivalent. And this is quite nice because it encodes all of the possible parses of the string in a polynomial amount of space. So to see this, here's one parse tree, and here's the other. But I could have exponentially many parse trees, and so they would all represent the same thing. And so as I already sort of alluded to, parsing we can really just think of, and Giorgio explained to you much better than I will, he explained to you on Thursday, that context tree parsing is really just intersection. So here, if I view this again as just a regular language where these are the states of the corresponding states of the automaton, I just happen to label them 0 through 4, then this is just, I'm just constructing an intersection here. So here's one way to see this. This actually goes back to a proof by Bar-Hillel and his colleagues in the early 60s. So they basically say, okay, so given, if you give me a context-free grammar G in Chomsky normal form, and some non-deterministic finite state automaton D, then I'm going to give you a new context-free grammar G prime that generates only the strings that are in the intersection of the two languages. So how do we do this? Basically, we take all of the binary rules in the grammar, And we add an every triplet of states in the automaton, and we basically add new non-terminal symbols. Basically, there's a non-terminal symbol for every non-terminal of the original grammar and pair of states in the automaton. And so we just add a bunch of rules that look like this to G prime. Then we add some rules for these terminal productions. So basically, whenever I see a pair of states, Q and R, such that I can get to Q from Q to R via some path labeled by W, and also A produces W, then I can add a production that looks like this. And then finally, we have to account for final states, so we do something like this. And so this bar Hillel construction generates a grammar G prime whose language is basically the language of the original grammar intersected with the language of the original automaton. And so the way to see this in our parse chart, I mean, you probably see it already. So CKY is really just doing an efficient construction of this, right? So if I do this for every rule and every triplet of states, I'll generate a bunch of things that might not actually lead to any be useful in any derivations. So CKY is just doing this somewhat more efficiently. So you can take CKY, and rather than run it on strings, you can run it on essentially an arbitrary regular grammar without too much trouble. So if you want to parse speech lattices, for instance, this is how you do it. So context-free parsing is basically just intersection. I'll show you this very explicitly here. So here's my parse chart, right? This is just a grammar rule in my intersected grammar. The grammar rule looks like this. And again, this is just a non-terminal label. So in my new grammar, I've got these funny non-terminal labels that look like this. So if I take the entire parse chart, I can read off a grammar that represents the intersection. And what this grammar does is it generates only that string, but it might generate it by multiple multiple different derivations. But it's just a grammar. Okay, so parsing really is intersection. And we can extend this idea to translation. Since now I have a grammar, suppose that this grammar was actually the left-hand side of some synchronous context-free grammar.
So
yes?
Back up a little bit.
Okay.
4.5, where you have the original grammar.
Okay.
That, I'm thinking, generates like four sentences?
Yeah, something like that.
Because
I think so.
There's only one derivative with the PRP, right?
Mm-hmm.
Single I on
earth. Yeah. That's right. Yes, it only generates that string.
I understood the analogy with what the chat parser is doing.
Right.
But I'm wondering what happens if the string at the bottom of your chart is not representable, or strings actually. You could have both of one string.
Okay.
You could have a general attack.
Okay.
Like, because as long as you can start from here, it'll go there. But what
right.
if it has loops?
If it has loops, that's okay. It's still just a. It's still just a finite state automaton. It's still a regular language.
But the chart parsing,
yeah, this construction still goes through. You might generate an infinite language, but that's okay. That's right. So the one way to think about the behavior of these non-terminals in this proof is to say, so when I construct this grammar, or when I construct any non-terminal in the Bar-Hillel construction, basically what it's saying is a non-terminal in this form, which is a non-terminal of the original grammar plus a pair of states, can only generate strings that could have been the yield of the non-terminal in the original grammar, and also the label of a path from this state to this state. Okay? And so it doesn't matter if that's an infinite number of strings, that's totally fine.
Okay, but you see, right? If you take a node, it has a span, and you know the orbit has a large span, so you always enlarge. But you have cycles, in your automaton, you could go back.
I can draw you an example later, but this is in fact what's happening. This is a very old proof, right? Okay, so I've just been talking about context-free grammars. Let's think again about synchronous grammars. So suppose that my original grammar had been sort of the left side, or rather the, let's see, the English projection of some synchronous context-free grammar. Remember, we had these paired productions. So what I could do is I could basically take these pairs of states and project them across that grammar to the corresponding non-terminal symbol. And so if I had done this, I would get a new grammar. This is another context-free grammar that I basically just projected across my synchronous context-free grammar. And what this grammar represents is a set of all possible translations of the English string. In this case, there's only two. And so this is kind of a nice algebraic way of thinking about things. So the original synchronous context-free grammar represents a relation on strings, right? So it's an infinite, possibly infinite relation over string pairs, right? So I got some string in English paired with some string in Spanish. And when we do this intersection, basically what we're doing is we're selecting the elements of that relation such that the left string, the English string, is the English string that we actually saw. And that's all we're doing. We're basically just selecting some subset of that relation. And so this isn't just a nice way to think about this. So I should mention, I learned this from a paper that Giorgio posted on his webpage almost 10 years ago. I don't know if, did it ever get published, Giorgio? Okay. This is a really cool paper. Everyone should read this paper. But this isn't just a theoretical idea. This is actually practically useful. So my good friend and colleague, Chris Dyer at Carnegie Mellon University, implemented essentially this algorithm in 2010 and got some super nice speed ups in a synchronous parse, a real live synchronous parsing problem. Where we're actually using this for statistical inference. And so this is really, really cool. And more people should read this. So I want to make a quick technical point about these synchronous context-free grammars. So let's think about something for a second. So before, in my finite state models of translation, I could express all possible permutations of a string. It turns out the dynamic programming algorithms for doing that are exponential, unless you use a bunch of heuristics and hacks. But I just told you that you could do parsing using translation methods, and that is obviously going to be polynomial. So why is this true? So the reason is that the set of permutations that you can express in your synchronous context-free grammar is going to be bounded by something that we'll call the rank. The rank is basically just the maximum number of non-terminals that I see on the right-hand side of any production. Right? So a rank 2 synchronous context-free grammar, this is a particularly well-known one called inversion transduction grammar, just in case you felt like the jargon in the literature wasn't sufficiently polluted. We have another name for this. Can't generate this sort of well-known alignment called an inside-outside alignment. And the way to see that is that there's no non-terminal that could produce pairs of spans that build up to a complete analysis of this, right? So if I chose, for instance, to generate this pair of strings, well, that leads to something discontinuous on the other side, and so that's not allowed in context-free grammar. So any pair of strings that I choose here has this problem. And so I can't represent this particular permutation. I can represent it if I add, if I increase the rank of this grammar, so if I allow it to have up to 4 symbols, but as it turns out, that also increases parsing complexity. So we kind of want to minimize this. So we won't want to, yes.
Is exactly this, yes.
This is exactly it. And so this is, again, this is an old result that's due to Ahon Ullman and also Dikai Wu in the computational linguistics is known for sort of identifying this as being an interesting problem. So that's basically the state of MT right now. This is how MT works right now, and how people have kind of wanted it to work in the last 10 years. We're just using very, very simple automata that were basic. All of them were introduced, say, almost more than 40 years ago. And so they're basically, they essentially represent. So I should mention all those automata that came out of the compiler literature, they were originally inspired by work in linguistics. And so basically we're working with linguistic models from 45 years ago. So that's how MT works. So in the last 10 years, we've gotten up to 45 years ago. And so you might imagine this has some problems in terms of representative, sort of representational capacity, right? So There are a few linguists in the room. And remember, I don't know anything about linguistics. I'm not making any linguistic claims necessarily, but I will point you to some claims made by some other people. Arguably, natural language is not context-free. There is actually a formal proof of this by Stuart Schieber, a computer scientist who wrote this down in 1985. And basically, it goes that you can construct there's a certain type of construction in Swiss German. This is related to cross-serial dependencies that produces strings that, under some homomorphism, look like this. And so if we intersect this thing with this regular language, it's something that looks like that. This is clearly not regular. It's also not context-free. And so since we know, in fact, I just gave you the proof that context-free languages are closed under regular intersection, that means that thing is not context-free. So even if you don't believe that, there are some really nice examples in the literature from the last few years, which I don't think I have them on this slide. There's been a lot of work on dependency tree banks in the last few years, sort of analyzing their structure and finding that there are many, many, many derivations. In Czech, I think it's up to about 23% of the derivations can't be described by some sort of context-free derivation process over the strings. And so that's quite interesting. It suggests that maybe we should be doing something beyond context-free. Obviously, our context-free grammars don't say anything about semantics, and so if we really want to preserve the semantics, then maybe we should model it in some way. That's very hand-wavy. There's been a lot of... here's even more hand-wavy. It's sort of arguably hard to make these things efficient. You can do it by making a lot of... So there's a lot of hairy engineering work that goes in there. So we really, really want to build models that have these linguistic properties or model some of these linguistic phenomena, and we need something more powerful than synchronous context-free grammars to do it. So here's a possible checklist. We want something that's linguistically expressive, preserves the semantics. We would like to have efficient algorithms or algorithms at all, but we also need some synchronous formalism. I'll come back to this point in a minute and give you sort of a pictorial view. But now I want to talk about something that possibly does some of these things. And I'll start out with, this is going to be a tutorial, so this is stuff that you haven't maybe seen before. So it's going to be based on something called combinatorial categorical grammar. So combinatorial categorical grammar is a grammar formalism that originated in the 30s with the work of a Polish philosopher, Kazimierz Adukiewicz, and was then rediscovered by our friend Bar Hillel in 1953 and was subsequently been developed by Mark Steedman and his collaborators at the University of Edinburgh over many, many decades. So I'm going to start by giving you a quick tutorial on a simplified version of this called categorical grammar, which is actually the grammar due to Adukiewicz. And so categorical grammar is going to look very, very similar to context-free grammar. So we're going to have a set of terminals. So we have some set of terminal symbols. We've got some set of what I'll call atomic categories. Don't worry about what that means just yet. Give me a few seconds. But you can think of them as non-terminals, right? So I have some terminals and non-terminal labels. That's easy. Now I'm going to have something interesting, something called the complete set of categories. So if A and B are categories, then A slash B and A backslash B are categories. Don't worry what that means. But notice that this definition is recursive. So I have an infinite set of categories. And finally, I have a lexicon, which is going to be a subset of terminals times basically a relation on terminals, categories, and lambda terms. So there's going to be a little bit of not real lambda calculus in here, but I'm going to use some lambda calculus notation. And the idea is very simple. Here's the words, here's the syntax, and here's the semantics. So we want to represent all of these things in one formal system. Okay? So now, this seems a little bit hairy, but hopefully when I show you the derivation, it will make sense. Here is, but I want to introduce a few terms. So here's one of these categories that's non-atomic. So we call these functional categories. And the idea is that it is actually a function. It's seeking arguments, NP, VP, and NP. If it finds these arguments, it returns an S. So within these complex categories, we have something called the target category. And we have a bunch of categories called the argument categories. And so now that we have the notation, the jargon out of the way, I'll just describe a derivation. So the idea, we're going to use this not to generate strings. We're not going to use it in a generative way, but rather to recognize strings. So this is equivalent For most formal systems, we know that we can have sort of a generative description, here's how the strings are generated, or a recognition algorithm. In many cases, they're equivalent. In many cases, you can convert between them. It's a little less clear how to do that here. I can talk to you about it offline, but we're just going to think about recognition at this point. So how would I recognize a string like this? The idea is that you can almost think of these as not quite unary context tree grammar rules, but we're going to do something very similar to what we did in the context tree case. So if I see a term like this that says I have we paired with this, I'm going to assume that whenever I see a word, I can associate it with this syntactico-semantic representation. So we're just going to tag all the words like this. Now, if it can be the case that I can have a word with multiple syntactico-semantic representations, that's totally fine. So both of them will come up in the parsing algorithm. But at this point, you can think of it as I basically inferred that perhaps this thing was associated with the word we. Okay? So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to combine these things. And the way I'm going to do this is by means of what we'll call a set of universal rules. And they're just two. They're called forward application and backwards application. And so the idea is that whenever I see a category, A slash B, that's next to a category B, then I'm going to combine them by saying that this B basically is the argument of this A slash B, so I just return A. And I also compose their semantics. So let's see what this looks like. Here's an example. I've got VP slash NP that's seeking an NP to its right. And so I'll call VP slash NP the primary premise. And the NP is going to be called the secondary premise. And so I can combine them this way. So here's what happens. I can think of these complex categories as basically just having stacks of arguments. So I pop this argument off, and I'm just left with VP, and I compose their semantic representations. Rather, it's just functional application. So here again, we have an example where I've got something like this, and I can combine it this way. Again, I just pop off the NP, and I just apply this representation to this. This is just functional application in the lambda calculus. And so we keep doing this until we've got a complete, basically, if we can derive the category S, then we recognize the string. And in addition to recognize the string, we've also assigned a semantic representation to it, which in this case, you can think of, this is basically just a tree or nested. I've written it as this nested word here. So this is a nested word language. It's basically just a language over trees. Under certain assumptions, you can think of this as basically describing a regular tree language. I'll come back to this a little bit. It's a little bit not completely true, but so here's something that's really interesting about this. Categorical grammar, as I just described it, is just context tree grammar, right? So CG is context tree. There's a proof again by Bar Hillel, who is sort of has his fingerprints all of this stuff. And remember I told you that categorical grammar was invented in the 30s, so everything you know about linguistics is wrong. But one interesting thing about this is that you can look at these categories here, and you can rewrite them to an equivalent lexicalized context-free grammar. And so if you just draw some little arrows over those context-free rules, you can also see this as essentially a kind of dependency grammar, which is pretty cool. In fact, this sort of analysis, not of context-free grammar particularly, but this kind of context-free grammar, this also originates in the 60s with Hayes and Gafman. So it's sometimes called a Hayes-Gafman grammar in this form. Everyone knows who David G. Hayes is, right? So David G. Hayes coined the term computational linguistics and was the first editor of the journal of the same name. So he's pretty important. There's all this interesting stuff that happened in the 60s. We're still not quite up to 1968 yet, but we're getting close. So now I'm going to make one change. So I'm going to tell you about combinatory categorical grammar, which is more powerful, and I'll show you why. So we're going to start out doing the same thing. Here's a sentence in Swiss German, or actually it's a fragment of a sentence. It's an embedded clause. And so we're going to analyze it in this way. So we're going to start out doing the same thing we did with CG. And now we have a problem, okay? So here I have this category which is looking for a VP to its right, and I've got a VP to its right, but this VP is still waiting for its NP argument. And so in category grammar, I can't do anything with this, right? So in order to get around this problem, because in categorical grammar, I basically need this thing to be atomic. So we're going to add some rules to get around this problem. We're going to call them forward composition. It looks a little bit hairy, but basically here's how you read it. I see if I've got A missing a B, and I see next to it B that has some number of arguments up to N, then I can basically just pop B off of A's stack, and I can append all of B's arguments to A. That's all that we do. So here's how this plays out. Here, I just pop this VP off of this stack, and I append the MP that belongs to VP to it, right? So there's a VP that belongs to MP. It just gets carried up. And so now the rest of this is basically just categorical grammar derivation. So it turns out to be fairly straightforward. But you'll notice something interesting happened with the dependency here, right? So if I draw the dependencies on this analysis, they look like this. So now I've got a non-projective dependency tree. And so this is maybe is a little too strong. This is closely related to something called mildly non-projective dependency grammar, which is there's been a lot of interesting work on in the last 10 years, primarily in the work of Marco Coleman and Emily Pittler. So they've both written a bunch of really, really cool papers about this in the last 30. This is like one of the best things I've read in computational linguistics and parsing in years. And so there is a formal description of this in terms of linear context-free rewriting systems. Don't worry about what that means, but basically, you know, you have these sort of hairy-looking dependency graphs. And so you can actually write them. They're a polynomial recognition algorithm. There is a polynomial recognition algorithm for CCG as well, but you get this crossing dependency because we've got this NP that basically the VP's argument jumped over the VP's parent. And so that's why we get something like, and so there are constructions like this that are quite common in Swiss German, Dutch, and other languages. And so this is nice. So this is something that we can't do with a context-free grammar. I'll prove it. Or at least I'll sketch the proof for you. So here is a CCG. So read this, so take a look at the CCG for a second. I want you to convince yourself that it always has the same number of A, that strings that I can recognize with it always have the same number of A's, B's, and C's. Okay, so whenever I see a B, I must see exactly one A and one C. Okay, so if I take this language generated by the CCG and I intersect it with A star, B star, C star, I get A to the N, B to the N, C to the N. Here's what a derivation looks like of one of those strings. And so you'll see kind of where the power comes from here is from the fact that I can build up these arbitrarily large categories. So we actually have some memory here that we don't have access to in something like a context-free derivation. And so we can generate these non-context-free derivations. Okay, so that's a lot of build up to now. I want to come back to synchronous formalism for a second. Okay, so here's a somewhat incomplete view of the universe of automata and formal languages and their, yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, this is a crazy crossing derivation.
So basically, first B goes to its nearest A on the right, and its nearest C on the left.
No, the so this B. Okay, so let's trace this A. So this A goes all the way up the derivation to here. So this B links to this A, and it's also going to link to the last C. And so this B, so there's also, it's also, there's just a chain along the Bs, but this B links to this A and that C and then so on. So they're inside out. Okay, so here's a sort of set of, it's not really clear whether this is an abstract family of languages, but I'll leave it in there. Here's a bunch of things. I don't know, how many people know what an index language is? Oh, Georgia, okay, wow, okay. I won't talk about index languages, but hopefully you've seen context-free and the other things. And so what's interesting is we know how to describe relations on regular languages. An FST basically just describes a relation on two regular languages, right? I get a regular language in and I get a regular language out. A pushdown assembler is a device for describing a relation on context-free languages. I get a context-free language in and I get a context-free language on the other side. If I look at either side of that relation, I've got a context-free language. We have no idea about this. This is sort of interesting. And so I'm not going to claim to sketch a complete solution of this, but I will sort of try to give you a sense of something interesting. So now one thing you might ask, so I just told you that a CCG basically, when I take the derivation, it gives you back a nested word language, which represents the semantics, right? So here's an idea. If I think of that, if I think of the CCG as basically describing a relation on strings and their semantic representations as trees, maybe one way I could construct the a relation on CCGs would be to say, take a CCG, and then take a CCG, take a CCG, say English to semantic representation, take a CCG from Spanish to semantic representation, and the way we define the relation is we basically just define the set of strings such that one string is generated by the English CCG, one string is generated by the Spanish CCG, and they have a semantic representation in common, right? That would be the natural thing to do, right? That we want to translate going through the semantics, and that would be something that you might. Now, there are a whole bunch of problems with this, like I have to solve semantic problems. I have to solve semantic parsing, but I want to show you a slightly, something that worries me a little bit more than that, and I'm going to do this in terms of what I'll describe as a simple card game. Hopefully some people have seen this before. So I've got an infinite set of cards. Although I have an infinite set of cards, just pretend it's infinite. I've got an infinite set of cards, but there's only a finite set of types of cards. And the cards all look something like this. So let's say I've only got three types of cards in this deck. Every card has two rows of symbols on it. Okay? So in this card game, the goal is to basically put down a sequence of these cards such that the string on the top row is equivalent to the string on the bottom row. Seems like this is a simple problem, right? So a solution in this deck would be something like this. So here, these two strings are equivalent. Okay? So this is a very simple computational problem. It's written up in a very nice 1946 paper, which is about 4 pages long. How many people are familiar with this problem? Okay, good. Some people know this problem, but two of them were in my class in the spring. I don't know if that counts. But so this is called the Post correspondence problem. It was invented in 1946 by a logician named Emil Post. Okay, so that's a Post correspondence problem. What does it have to do with anything? Okay, so now I'm going to show. Now let's go back to CCGs for a second. So here is a sort of is an example of the Post correspondence problem written down in numbers and words. I've got basically here are my cards. These are the same cards I showed you earlier. But I've just written a pair of strings, and I've indexed them. I've given them, given each pair an index, right? So there's a first, second, and third. So if I have an example of the post correspondence problem, I can actually write down CCGs, a pair of CCGs that are going to solve the post correspondence problem. So this looks hairy, but the construction is actually quite simple. Basically, for each one of these cards, I encode it. I basically just encode the card. Here's the string on the card. Here's the first string on the card. Here's the index of the card. And we do the same thing over here with grammar B with the second strings on the card, right? And so now, derivations in these CCGs look something like this. Don't worry too much about the details. They look kind of hairy, like when I write them down this way. It turns out that these derivations all produce monadic trees, more vulgarly known as strings. And so if we look at the string representation of these semantics, basically what this thing generates is, given an input sentence, the semantics will basically be just some sequence of cards in the post-correspondence problem. Okay? So now, we want to come back to the question, what would happen if I basically took these CCGs and said, I'm going to say a string has the same semantics as some other, a string grammar A has a semantics of a string grammar B, I'm going to create a relation that says all strings such that the string in grammar A with a semantic representation that's equivalent to some semantic representation of a string in grammar B. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that that would be equivalent to solving the post-correspondence problem. Does anyone see the problem with this? The post-correspondence problem is undecidable. So what that means is that we are not going to be able to map through arbitrary semantic readings, right? And so this This little sketch that I gave you is actually just sort of a re-encoding of a classic undecidability proof for the intersection of context tree grammars. So context tree grammars, if you take their intersection, it is undecidable whether or not that intersection contains any strings. In this case, it's undecidable whether there's a pair of strings that have the same semantics. And this kind of proof also holds up for things like synchronous hyper-edge replacement grammar and a bunch of other formalisms that we're interested in using for semantic translation. So this is a little bit worrisome. So this means that we aren't going to get to efficient algorithms. So in the last, I'm going to take just like a few more minutes and try to sketch what we might do. So we're going to do this by trying to come up with a synchronous CCG. And I'm going to have to rush through this, but that's OK. There's a bunch of fine print that no one in this room except Giorgio will care about. So here's an idea. Suppose that we develop a synchronous CCG. How would we do that? We want a synchronous CCG that does not lead to undecidable decision problems. So first, so in my synchronous CCG, I basically just have paired lexical entries, right? So rather than having, you know, just a bunch of, this looks very much like sort of paired entries in a context tree grammar. I've got these paired lexical. Basically, this is trying to say that these words have identical semantics, but they also have to resolve some predicate argument structure. So we've got a left projection. There is a right projection. Both the left and right projections must be CCGs. And in these paired lexical items, the semantics must be isomorphic up to the ordering of bound variables. So therefore, because of the way this works, they are also going to be isomorphic up to the order and directionality of their arguments. So how I might recognize something like this. So suppose I've got two strings. And I want to recognize where they're generated by the synchronous CCG. So each string must be a permutation in projection of a shared set of lexical entries. So that is, there must be an alignment. Okay. So each string must be derivable in its projection, sort of independently of the other string. I have some way of deriving this if I just look at the rules of the CCG, and likewise for the other. And also, there must be a pair of derivations with identical semantics. This is like a parlor trick, right? What am I doing that is making it possible to say I can have these strings that have these identical semantics? So I'll show you in just a second, but I want to also show you something interesting about this, is that there's no, you saw this thing already, right? This is the permutation that's not representable by rank 2 synchronous context tree grammar. That means that there's no binary branching derivation process that can produce this thing. So how are we going to do this? Like, we can't like just pair up the rules in the CCG and get something like this. That's very puzzling. Okay. So I'm going to give you a bit of a set here. So remember that each derivation has a corresponding dependency tree. That's deterministic. It's just once, if I give you the derivation, you can read off the dependency tree. So we can view, again, the string. The CCG is defining a relation between strings and these derivation trees, which here I'm going to write over the lexical entries. So suppose that what I do is I restrict myself to homomorphic images of this. Basically, given my synchronous CCG, I'm only looking at images of this semantic interpretation. And so this means I'm not computing things that are arbitrarily semantically the same. I'm only basically going to look at semantic that basically have the same derivation structure. Basically, they compose in the same way. And so if I can find some string for which this is the corresponding semantics, then we're done. Okay. So how hard is it to do this? I should really finish up here in just in the next few minutes. So I'll skip over some of it, but I'll give you a sketch. So the idea is that if I give you the synchronous combinatory categorical grammar and a string pair UV, we want to construct a CCG producing all and only the set of, the valency trees are these sort of semantic tree, these tree-like representations of semantics. So we want to construct a CCG producing all and only the set of valency trees and derivations of U. So if we can do this, then we can do the standard projection trick that we do with context tree grammars. And then we can just parse the other string. This is exactly the same algorithm I showed you that Chris Dyer uses to parse context tree grammars, except this construction is interesting. So can we come up with a bar Hillel construction for CCG? You would think that you would be able to. It turns out under various assumptions that is equivalent to other things for which we have these instructions. So I spent some time looking around to see if I could find one. And I couldn't, I spent weeks and I tried to come up with it on my own. It's hard and I, so eventually I just gave up and I asked Mark, like, is there a constructive proof that CCG is closed under an intersection? And he gave me a very, very worrying response. Like, he's like, I don't know if there is one. And so I thought, so then I worked on it for a while and I thought, this is hard. Like, there's something really hard in this problem. I need someone really, really smart to help me with this problem. And I thought, who is the smartest person that I know? And so I, one day I just went up to Jason's office and I posed this question to him that I posed to Mark. Most people can probably imagine this. So Jason was sitting at his desk, at his table, and he leapt up from the table. He's like, oh, it should be trivial. And he goes off the board and he writes something down. I'm like, Jason, that's wrong. And I pointed out to him where it was wrong. So he writes something down. And then we were in there for like basically the entire afternoon writing down things and other things. And basically we could not come up with an answer to this question. But now I know Giorgio, so I'm hoping that Giorgio will help me with this. So Jason was the smartest person I knew until I came to the workshop. Okay, so we're gonna do something easier. We're gonna intersect CCG with a finite language, right? I don't have to actually intersect with an arbitrary regular language because I'm never gonna translate arbitrary regular languages. I'm an NT guy. All I care about is like translating strings, or at worst, like the output of an ASR system. And those are all gonna be finite languages. So let's just throw out arbitrary regular languages and do this with an acyclic NFA. And so I'll kind of sketch how this is gonna look like. This is just gonna be very, very intuitive sketch. But the idea is this. So I'm going to take, so suppose this is my sentence with my valency tree over the sentence, which is basically described by possibly multiple derivations. We're going to associate to it some kind of expression that corresponds to the yield in the sentence, right? So this looks a lot like a bar Hillel construction. Basically, if this MP spans 1 through 3, then I basically just assign it something like 1 through 3. Except I've got this problem with this VP here. What do we do with this VP? The VP, if I look at this dependency tree, actually spans two disjoint spans of the string. So here's what I claim is going to be one way of doing that, is an expression that looks like this. I won't go through the details, but I'll give you a quick sketch. One note is about the compositional behavior of categories is, we're gonna skip all this. But I'll show you basically the idea. So the idea is that here I've got a VP. I know at this point in this derivation that this VP spans positions 6 through 7. And then I've got a remainder here. So I'm going to record this remainder. And then I'm going to look at the rest of the derivation tree and show you, essentially see that I got a, basically at this point I spanned all of this and I've got a gap at 5 to 6. And if that went by you too fast, I apologize. But that's the basic idea. So essentially what we have are these, basically if you look at the yield of categories, so if I had some category A that was in here that spans some word, I got a remainder here, which then gets passed up as a secondary of, I'm not gonna go through it, but we've got a construction that I think is correct. And so going back to recognition, just suppose that you believe this is correct. So if I have a construction like this, then I'm gonna claim that this G prime produces only strings with this valency tree. That doesn't necessarily mean it produces only this string, just only the strings that have this semantic interpretation. And so now going back to recognition, I can take this CCG that I've read off the parse, I can project it through my synchronous CCG, and so now I'm going to get an English CCG that generates all possible strings that are translations of the sentence according to this synchronous. So coming back to the problem about arbitrary regular languages, it has this interesting property that we can come up with dependency trees that have essentially span an arbitrary number of disjoint spans. And so this is the problem that Jason and I got stuck on. Don't worry about what this means. This is really quite puzzling and we have no idea how to get around it. But this is interesting because this is just a regular language. So this is why I'm not able to come up with a construction for an arbitrary regular language. But, okay, so there's a bunch of things that are totally unsolved here, including possibly what I just described to you. So One thing to point out is CCGs don't just produce these tree-like derivations, they actually produce DAGs. So this is how CCG parsers are used in practice. This was like 2002. So there's a clear relation between CCG parsing and AMR parsing. We produce some kind of DAG representation of the semantics. Then there are all these features of CCG that are quite interesting that I won't talk about. But I think there are at least some directions forward, and I'm happy to talk to people here about any of this. I think there's probably a synchronous formalism that I kind of just sketched. But I want you to remember all the things that Giorgio told you on Thursday about intersection constructions, especially intersection constructions. Parsing is intersection. And really taking like an algebraic view of your problem before you really kind of go down into the algorithms. And so that is, I think, all that I have to say. Okay. Questions? Yes.
Problem you asked, is CCG closed under intersection with regular languages?
CCG closed under intersection with regular languages.
Okay, this problem that you...
Yes, that needs to be true in order for you to have a construction.
Okay.
And so under certain...
No, but wait. So...
This is not, actually, which is interesting.
No, what I want to tell you that the class of CCG that you showed up here,
it's not closed under regular intersection.
It is not closed.
In fact, it's not closed, and one thing that's interesting about the construction is it doesn't require you to generate the set of strings in the intersection. Only the set of valency trees over strings that are in the intersection.
Yes.
So it can, in fact, produce strings that are not in the intersection,
okay,
which is a kind of subtle point. But then there are certain variants of CCG that we know to be closed, but we don't have a construction for it.
Okay.
Which is also somewhat of a puzzle. That would be the variant that is equivalent to the tag, which I know you have looked at.
Okay.
Thanks for a nice talk. So you showed a slide where showing that people had taken synchronous context tree parsing to do MTU, and they'd done a ton of optimizations to make it actually practically fast enough to be used for MTU. Do you think it's going to be the same story with more powerful models like this, where you'll define something will be horribly intractable, and then people will do more optimizations?
So this is a really good question. And so there's an interesting story about this, which is that the Steve Clark parser, which I mentioned at the end in 2002, that was already a really, really fast parser in 2002, a lot faster than most of your tree bank parsers. And the reason for this is that they rely on a trick that came out of not this particular formalism, but a related formalism called tree adjoining grammar. And they use something called super tagging. So the idea, some of you probably know what super tagging is, but essentially you can run a Markov model over the assignment of categories to words, and that does most of the parsing for you. And so that's really fast, and you prune basically most of the space of the parser, and then suddenly you get a really, really fast parser. There's a lot more that I could say about that, but essentially we have really, really good hacks for making CCG fast that aren't really applicable to context-free, arbitrary context-free grammars. So possibly yes. Yes.
I'm not sure my question is well formulated yet, but when you're describing these synchronous CCGs, you said, imagine you have a synchronous CCG given to you, so its left side is a CCG, right projection is a CCG, and then I give you a pair of strings along with an alignment.
I'm sorry?
Along with an alignment.
Well, no, I'm not going to give you a pair of strings along with the alignment, just a pair of strings.
Okay. And
so synchronous parsing works out the alignment.
Okay, all right. So what I was wondering is whether if the resulting alignment doesn't violate one of those CFG, SCFG constraints, you know, that you can't have these funny crossings, 1, 4, 2, 3, or whatever it was. So if it doesn't do that, will the resulting restriction of the SCFG actually be expressible as a, SCCG be expressible as an SCFG? In other
crossing alignments? It would depend on whether the languages themselves were CC. That's a good question.
I don't know.
If all of the permutations always have this property, which would probably only be true under fairly strong assumptions.
I'm thinking about given a set of string pairs, or even just one pair of strings, the restriction of the CCG to the synchronous CCG to produce that string, whether that is expressible as a synchronous. And the reason I'm thinking of that is
Well, actually, yes, and yes, you should be
and
able
there
to
might
write
be some
down.
Non-projective ways also, but I don't know.
I take that back, actually. I am not entirely sure. So the problem is that even if you could write down a CFG for the finite side that you're given, can we write down a corresponding CFG? I don't think you can, actually, because you can still have discontinuities in the other side. The discontinuities in the other side are a result of the interaction between the derivation trees and the grammar of the target language CCG.
Right.
It's not hard-baked into anything about the derivation rules.
Okay. Now, the reason I'm thinking about it is because we have all this existing work on using SCFGs for translation. You start with parallel corpora, you build all kinds of stuff.
No, I've done some of this.
So I'm wondering whether we just need to focus on sort of the little bit that the CCG needs to contribute where you have non-projective.
Yeah, so Johnny Weiss and Chris Kossenbirch and I had a paper about this a couple years ago, and so it was pretty disappointing. Okay. I think you would have a lot more if you could actually represent the syntactic correspondences in the two languages, which you can't do if you try to shoehorn it into a context-free formalism.
No, meaning use the context-free formalism as your starting point, and you say we'll just add enough other things to accommodate.
Might be that what you want to do, let me go back up to, maybe rather than looking at a formalism like this, which is fairly hard to understand and the theory is not very well worked out, we do have a very well-developed theory of mildly non-projective dependency grammar.
Right.
And so, in fact, there's a synchronous formalism based on, it's actually almost trivial to come up with a synchronous formalism for this. And you could actually represent a lot of the things using this. But it's still non-context free.
But no, that's okay. Okay.